Hello and welcome to this week's Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today we're coming to you from far north Queensland with some local research with wide-reaching consequences. Could worms prevent type 2 diabetes? Good news about hepatitis C, bad news about an HIV and syphilis epidemic, a potentially devastating skin ulcer which could have been misconceived, and causing an infection to prevent one. But let's start with this intriguing notion that a parasitic worm might be protective against type 2 diabetes and its forerunner called the metabolic syndrome. To talk about that is one of the researchers involved, Robin McDermott, who's Professor of Public Health Medicine at James Cook University here in Cairns. Welcome to the Health Report.
Thank you, Norman.
So what worm are we talking about here? Presumably we're not talking about earthworms.
Well, in a way they are. They're soil-transmitted worms, and there's three main families of worms that infect humans that live in the soil. One is Ascaria family, then there's the Strongyloides family, and then there's hookworms. And we first noticed in one of the East Kimberley communities that adults who'd had a previous infection with Strongyloides stercoralis, which is a highly endemic worm.
And just before we go on, what does Strongyloides do when you catch it, when you've got it?
Strongyloides has a life cycle which involves living in the soil, eggs in the soil, and then hatching and then burrowing through humans or others through bare feet, and then burrowing up through the tissues and ending up in the gut through the lungs. And so it has a long journey to go through all the human tissues.
And what did you notice?
Well, we noticed that adults who'd had a previous infection with this worm were highly protected from type 2 diabetes. It was about a 60% protection. Now, this was a cross-sectional study, so we couldn't infer
causality. Meaning you weren't following them through, you were taking a snapshot rather than following
That's
people
right.
through.
But most likely these worm infections had been got in childhood or early adulthood, and people get type 2 diabetes later on. Then we looked around to see what other human studies there were in the world. And there were only two with diabetes or metabolic syndrome as an outcome, or three others.
And we should say what metabolic syndrome is. This is a fat tummy, so you've got abdominal fat.
Yes.
You've got high insulin levels, you've got high blood pressure, and you're heading towards type 2 diabetes.
Yes, and you've got an abnormal lipid profile and probably living in a very pro-inflammatory state, which affects
Meaning
pretty much every organ
of
your body.
Your immune system's activated.
Yes, yes. And the pathway for this is through activated white adipose tissue, which generates what's called a type 1 immune response, which means that the macrophages are all activated.
So these are white cells you're talking about that
yes.
chomp up things.
Yes. So for people that are carrying a lot of visceral fat around the tummy, this implies that this is one of the pathways by which the hepatic cells are upregulated and pushes over several years into a glucose intolerance.
Now, you've associated the eradication of worms with the increase of type 2 diabetes in Aboriginal communities.
Oh, I haven't been so bold as to say that.
I think I read it in one of your papers.
We
just need to read your papers.
We were wondering if we were perhaps doing some harm if we didn't look at the consequences of these population-wide eradication programs. A recent Cochrane review suggested that mass drug administration for worms in developing countries had no impact on general nutrition levels and iron deficiency anemia and school performance and growth in general. So I think we have to revisit the vilification of worms.
So you've done a review of the literature, we'll come to your laboratory research in a minute, or your colleague's laboratory research. You've done a review of the literature and you found a relationship between worms
yes.
and types. It doesn't mean it's cause and effect, though.
Oh, no. The four studies that we included in this review, because there were very few human studies, because most societies which still have worms don't have diabetes and vice versa. There are a few transitional populations and...
Meaning you're going from developing to developed?
Yes. Yeah, where you still have a lot of infectious disease, but you also have a lot of obesity and obesity-related chronic disease, including diabetes. And Australian Aboriginal people, some of them are in that category. But we found two other studies from China that found the same thing, and one in Indonesia.
And this is all worms, not just Strongyloides?
Ours was just looking at strongyloides. The Indonesian and the Chinese studies were looking at all worms.
So you implied there was something to do with the immune system here. Yes. Type 1 diabetes is an immune disease, an autoimmune disease.
Indeed.
We've heard about worms and asthma because you don't get your immune system trained up and therefore you get more tendency to allergy. But I'm still not seeing the relationship between worms and type 2 diabetes unless what they're doing is chomping up all the calories and stopping you getting type 2 diabetes because they're consuming all the excess calories. I mean, what's going on?
They could be making you thin, but that's unlikely because once we controlled for BMI in these studies, it wasn't mediated through weight loss. There is the mouse studies, and there are a lot of them now, not just ours, are showing that it's mediated through an immune pathway which is modulatory. So it's a T helper 2. It's a secondary pathway which normally we have, and it resides in the.
So this is a complicated immune system, but where how does that affect, how does this complicated immune story that you're just telling me affect type 2 diabetes, which is not an immune disease? You're telling me it is an immune disease.
Well, type 2 diabetes is a disease of chronic inflammation, and that chronic inflammation originates in the visceral fat tissues.
So apart from questioning whether you should eradicate these worms, is there a therapeutic option here? Do you deliberately, you know, infect people, not just Aboriginal people, but anybody who's liable to type 2 diabetes and see whether or not they don't get it? I mean, what's the story?
There's only one trial going on at the moment, and the results are in press, and it's by a group in Indonesia.
And where they've deliberately infected people with worms?
No, they didn't. None of those, the deliberate infection of humans hasn't been tried yet. This study actually got a bunch of households who were in a worm endemic area, and without knowing their worm status, they allocated randomly half of the households to get 3-monthly worm infection.
Ah, so it was a trial of eradication to see whether or not it actually caused diabetes.
Indeed,
right.
Indeed. To see whether the people who did get the treatment, whether their insulin resistance was increased.
And we don't know yet.
I can't give you the
results.
You're
sworn to have to kill the audience if you tell them.
But a recent review looked at all this and suggested that really it was time for human trials.
And you're planning one here?
We are.
And what's that, just very briefly, because we're on out of time, what's that going to look like, that trial?
Well, it's a phase one trial. We're looking at the safety and tolerability of worms. Of a given dose of human hookworm, which we incubate out at James Cook University in healthy volunteers. And we're looking for young women with who don't have diabetes yet, but who are on the road to getting it. So young women with a waist circumference of over 90, and with one or two other features of the metabolic syndrome.
Right. Well, we look forward to hearing more about this. This is an interesting trial there, which is totally counterintuitive. Robin McDermott, thanks very much indeed. Robin is Professor of Public Health Medicine at James Cook University here in Cairns. And you're listening to the Health Report here on Radio ABC Radio National, ABC News and CBC Radio across Canada. Well, I talked about causing infection to prevent one. The one we're trying to prevent is dengue fever. And as somebody who's had dengue, let me tell you, you don't want to get it again. I certainly don't want to get it again because it's worse when you actually get it again. But very unpleasant. Lost about 2 kilos in about 24 hours and felt like death. And there has been dengue in far north Queensland. And they're, and with climate change, they predict more. But could we actually stop mosquitoes by creating an infection in them from transmitting dengue? And somebody who's working on that is Professor Scott Ritchie, also of James Cook University. Welcome to the Health Report, Scott.
Good to see you, Norman.
So this is so you've been trying to infect mosquitoes with a bacterium.
Yeah, absolutely. So the primary vector of dengue is a mosquito called Aedes aegypti. And it's really the only mosquito we've got up here in North Queensland in this area that carries dengue.
And dengue's a virus.
Dengue's a virus. And if you infect this mosquito with this bacteria called Wolbachia,
Just to double back for a second, while I cast off about dengue and my own personal experience, just tell us what dengue is, how it affects people, because it affects people in different ways.
Yeah, so dengue is actually a group of four different viruses. And generally, most people get what they call classic dengue fever, headache, severe pain behind the eyes, nausea, vomiting, a rash. You can lose quite a bit of weight. But you can get severe dengue and actually can kill you, potentially. The main problem with dengue...
And if you get one type, you're not immune to the other.
No, you're not.
And it gets worse each time you get it.
Yeah, you can get in what they call immune enhancement in the second bout of dengue from the different virus type can be more severe.
So tell us about this bacterium.
So the bacteria is called Wolbachia. And actually what it does, when it infects a mosquito, it actually can help to block infection with dengue virus. And what it does is they don't quite understand the mechanism. It can upregulate the mosquito's own immune system, or it can also compete for key nutrients in the cell that the virus needs to replicate. But basically what happens is it reduces the capacity for the virus to replicate in the mosquitoes, and you have greatly reduced ability for that group of mosquitoes to transmit the virus.
So that's in the lab?
That's in the lab, but it's also been done in the field where they've taken field-collected mosquitoes and exposed them to virus and look at what sort of transmission they rate. How much virus is coming out of the spit of the mosquito? And they've even fed them on people who have had dengue and did this similar sort of experiment.
I hope nobody's eating with this. Moving from roundworms to strongyloides to spit of mosquitoes. Okay, and you've been working in collaboration with U.S. researchers on this.
Yeah, actually, it's been led by a fellow named Scott O'Neill at Monash University. So he's really the head of the whole project. And there's been a lot of different groups involved. But I was part of the original group that was involved here in North Queensland. And we reared the mosquitoes and did the initial trials in semi-filled cages. And we're just about finished with releases here in North Queensland.
So tell me about these releases.
Well, basically, it's pretty straightforward. You rear the mosquitoes. They're all infected with Wolbachia. And you've got a cup that might have about 100 mosquitoes in it, and you release that cup every fourth house. That's one way. We call that an adult release. The other way is they actually put out little containers that where you put a strip that has about 150 mosquito eggs, fill it with water, add a little pellet of fish food, and they sort of hatch their own in the field. And they've engaged the community, and particularly school kids, school children, to do this sort of do-it-yourself Wolbachia program.
And you've been doing it in quite large areas around Cairns.
Yeah. I mean, we're almost completely done with Cairns after this year. And same with Townsville.
So are you relying on these 100 mosquitoes that are affected with Wolbachia to pass on the Wolbachia to their fellow mosquitoes, or for them to just, you know, go forth and multiply, as they would say?
Well, basically, they pass it on their offspring. So what happens is we do a series of releases, and after about 2 to 3 months of releases, you generally get to the point where you're approaching 80-90% of the mosquitoes are infected with it. And once it's infected, they pass it on to all their offspring. And so it persists. It's sustainable in the environment. So once you have it in, it generally stays in.
I'm sorry, so, but if it's only 100 mosquitoes at a time, what about the existing mosquitoes that don't have Wolbachia? Do they catch it?
Well, basically, it's a bit complicated, but what happens is...
It always is.
It works two ways. So a male mosquito that has Wolbachia, when it mates with a wild female that doesn't have Wolbachia, it sterilizes her. So that takes out part of the population,
so
right?
It's like chlamydia for
mosquitoes. Yeah. Then... your females that you release that have Wolbachia, when they mate with a wild male that doesn't have Wolbachia, all of those eggs end up infected with Wolbachia.
Right.
So you can see it's a powerful drive mechanism.
So what's happened in Cairns then as a result of that? So you've got a Wolbachia-infested mosquito population. What's happened to dengue in the Cairns area?
Well, this has been the lowest I've ever seen it in all my years of being here. it's just almost disappeared. I think we've had 2 cases of dengue in Kansas here. And so far, we haven't had any locally acquired dengue in areas where Wolbachia has been established.
And is that just...
That's me knocking on wood.
Knocking on wood. And but these things come and go. You can have a bad dengue season, you can have a good dengue season. Is it just an accident of fate?
Well, the other interesting thing is we've had more and more imported cases of dengue coming in the last 5 or 6 years. And so the pressure, the number of dengue cases coming in, the pressure for outbreaks has actually increased in the last 5 years, but the number of cases has increased. So we feel pretty strong. Look, it's not a randomized controlled trial, but it's good observational trial, sort of before and after, and it's pretty compelling.
So there are 2 other diseases that Aedes aegypti transmit. One is yellow fever and the other is Zika virus, which we've heard a lot about. Does Wolbachia work here too?
Well, it appears to. In fact, for Zika, it looks like it works real well. For yellow fever, it looks like it knocks it back too. And then there is a 4th one, Norman, chikungunya.
Oh, this very nasty viral
disease.
Yeah,
that's right. So it works for that. So it works universally within this particular mosquito. This is the only mosquito that we have, Wolbachia, that's being used this way is in the mosquito Aedes aegypti.
And it's clearly scalable.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, the good part is that once you have it in an area, it appears to sustain itself. Although it is a work in progress and we'll have to follow it years to come.
I'll have to come back up to Cairns to find out.
You will.
Scott Ritchie, thanks very much for joining us. Scott Ritchie is in the Australian Institute of Tropical Health and Medicine at James Cook University here in Cairns. Now, one of the other things that's going on in Cairns at the moment around this area in far north Queensland is what looks like an HIV and syphilis epidemic. But there's also good news in far north Queensland about hepatitis C. To talk about that is the Director of Cairns Sexual Health Service, Darren Russell. Welcome to the Health Report.
Thank you.
So tell us the good news, first of all, about hepatitis C.
Okay. In March of last year, the 1st of March last year, the federal government made available on the PBS, the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme, these new hepatitis C drugs. They've been around for a couple of years, but they're hideously expensive, and so we didn't have access to them until they came onto the PBS. With that, we've been able to treat and cure hepatitis C usually in 8 or 12 weeks, sometimes 24 weeks. Previously, it took 24, 48 weeks of a horrible treatment, so it wasn't scalable. We couldn't treat everyone. Now we really can treat everyone. And so straight after that announcement was made at the end of 2015 that these drugs would be available, a group of us got together in Cairns and said, we're going to make Cairns Hep C free by 2020. And we said that was free and 2020, it rhymes, so it's very scientific the way we came across that. But we're actually achieving that. We
And you're particularly focused on the prisons, where there's a very high prevalence of hepatitis C.
Well, you know, we people who work in infectious diseases really just regard prisons as viral incubators. You know, people go in, they may not have a virus or they may have a virus. They then mingle with other people who have viruses and then they come out the other end with viruses back into the community. So we thought this was a perfect place. It's also, excuse the pun, a captive audience. And we know how many people are in there. We know how many people have got Hep C because we test everyone going in. And we went up, and we go up monthly or more often if we need to, and we treat everyone up there. One of the nurses up there, Harris, is doing a fantastic job at getting people onto treatment. We have now cleared the prison of hepatitis C virus. It took us about 9 or 10 months. First prison in Australia, possibly the first in the world, to be free of Hep C because of these treatments.
You haven't been so lucky in far north Queensland with HIV or syphilis.
No, that's the other side of the coin, unfortunately. A syphilis epidemic occurred or started in January 2011, in the Gulf of Carpentaria and the Mount Isa region of far north Queensland, and has spread. And it's pretty much out of control in a sense. It's crossed into the Northern Territory, Kimberley region of Western Australia, and just November last year hit South Australia too. It's an indigenous epidemic in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. It's caused the death of 4 babies from congenital syphilis.
People have probably forgotten what syphilis is.
It's one of those old-fashioned sort of biblical diseases, isn't it? You know, it's a bacterial infection that passes on sexually and can pass on mother to baby, can pass on in the blood through blood transfusions if the blood's not screened. but it's predominantly sexual. And it's got three main phases, a primary, secondary, tertiary. And it was the thing that sent people mad in the old days or caused heart disease or terrible disfiguring lesions and sores that are terribly painful and noses would drop off and things like that. It was, you know, horrendous several centuries ago. We still have it, but on a much smaller scale.
So why has it taken off in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities?
Yeah, that's the question. I wish I knew. I think there's a few reasons.
I mean, it's curable with one penicillin injection, isn't
it? That's it. One injection of penicillin cures it. Probably within hours, it's the people are...
So it's eminently controllable.
Eminently controllable. It's really a failure of health systems in Aboriginal communities and Aboriginal healthcare generally that we have such an outbreak in 2017.
What sort of numbers?
Well, the epidemic so far, we're up to 1,406 cases as at the end of March, as I said, across the four states and territories, and still going on. Cairns would seem to be the epicentre of it at the moment, unfortunately.
And what are you trying to do about it?
There's a big scheme. There's a sort of multi-jurisdictional task force from members from across the country.
That's not going to work unless Aboriginal communities own the issue. So community-controlled organisations and so on, presumably they're involved?
They are involved, and the state government here in Queensland has committed funding to a North Queensland STI action plan, and one of the aims of that is really to get rid of congenital syphilis and to greatly reduce
syphilis. That's extraordinary. Four babies dying of congenital syphilis.
In a country like Australia in this day and age, it's almost unbelievable. It shouldn't occur. So there's a lot of work going on. The Indigenous communities are involved. Lots of health promotion work going on. But so far, we're not seeing any real tangible effects.
And hand in hand with that, or maybe or hand in hand, is an HIV epidemic, presumably with the same root causes?
Absolutely. It's a disadvantage again. So we normally have in Cairns one or two Indigenous cases of HIV each year. In the last 4 years, it's gone up. We had 14 last year, and this year we've still got cases. It's now crossed to the Northern Territory. It's gone up to Torres Strait and Cape York in small numbers.
And what pattern is this? Is this heterosexual epidemic with the intravenous drug use, or is it men who have missed sex with men, or what?
A bit from column A and a bit from column B. We're not seeing much associated with injecting drug use, though they're certainly associated with, you know, alcohol and drug use in general, but it's heterosexual and it's MSM, men having sex with men. So it's both occurring, and once again appears to be out of control at this stage.
So this is a question of that, I mean, you know, it's a question of Aboriginal communities, you know, taking control of this and trying to do something about it with enough help from the rest of the community.
Partly, but you've also got bigger cities involved, and Aboriginal communities in a place like Cairns, it's not a really cohesive place. It's not a small town where you can get everyone together and do a lot of intensive work. It's a big population here. So towns, Cairns, Townsville, Darwin, big cities like this are at great risk.
Darren Russell, again, another story we'll need to catch up on, but thank you very much for joining us on the Health Report.
Thanks.
We'll stay with infectious disease. It's been a very infectious disease program. John McBride's with me, who's Professor of Medicine at James Cook University and the College of Medicine here. And you've been looking at another infection here, John. It goes by different names. So if you're in Victoria, it's called Bairnsdale ulcer. If you're in Africa, it's called Bruelli. Up here, it's called the Daintree ulcer, and there's other names for it elsewhere. But it's a mycobacterial disease like leprosy or tuberculosis.
Yes. In fact, it's the third most common mycobacterial disease after tuberculosis and leprosy. A big problem in Africa, where its official name is Bruelli ulcer. Yeah.
So the mycobacterium is a bug, basically, another bacterium
it's
to add to
of,
our bacterial conversation here.
But there are hundreds of other mycobacteria that cause various... some can cause minor skin infections, some cause lung infections and so on, but they're all quite rare. These are the big three mycobacteria.
So what happens when you get infected with this mycobacterium that causes the Bairnsdale or Daintree ulcer?
Okay, so this is a special mycobacteria that's got produces a toxin called mycolactone. And this mycolactone toxin is an immunosuppressant. So it sort of reduces inflammation around where the infection occurs, and the mycobacteria are able to survive and multiply and eventually cause necrosis of the underlying fat and the skin, and you get a large, often painless ulcer because there's not much inflammation, and the ulcer can grow and become quite malignant, I suppose, not malignant in the sort of traditional sense.
And this has nothing to do with the mythical white spider. This is a different kind of infection.
No, this is...
And they're changing the way they think about this, because we've done stories on this before, but from Victoria, where they reckon that because it's wet swampland, it's aquatic born. But in fact, they reckon it's possum poo in Victoria.
Yes, indeed. So it's the traditional wisdom is that this is a mycobacterium that's found in water, and it's water exposure, and all the teaching that came out of Africa was that young children were getting Burrelia ulcers on their lower limbs and areas exposed to water when they went wading or swimming. And there was really nothing much to sort of much information to go against that dogma until our colleagues in Victoria made some very interesting observations about possums and came up with a model for the transmission of Mycobacterium ulcerans, which is the Bairnsdale ulcer, around Melbourne. And of course, Melbourne, the two areas in Australia where this ulcer occurs is the Daintree area in North Queensland and around Victoria,
particularly the Latrobe Valley.
Yeah. And you couldn't really get two more different ecological niches for, and it's fascinating to understand, try and understand why this is occurring in these two areas.
So is it a mammal passing it in the Daintree?
Well, this is what we're testing at the moment. So we are in a unique position where we have a climate like African climate, and are we sort of more in the Victorian model where a small mammal is transmitting this bacteria, or is it like the African model where people are exposed to water? So we've got plenty of anecdotal evidence to sort of suggest that a lot of people who've caught mycobacteria aren't fitting the demographic of what happens in Africa. They're not wading in water. And in fact, we've had people who've acquired one of these ulcers who've never been outside their house.
And something clearly happened in 2011 in not far north Queensland, because you had an outbreak then too. And we were talking about the other outbreaks. I'm being slightly facetious here, but you've also been dealing with the Bairnsdale Daintree ulcer outbreak.
Yeah, that really caught our attention in 2011.
Far north Queensland tourist board is going to love it.
We'd been sort of aware of the disease for many, many decades, and the old matron at the Mossman Hospital, who's now retired, did her master's thesis recording all of the historical incidents of the disease. But there was a big outbreak in 2011. It was a big, big wet season, and coincidentally, Victoria had a massive outbreak in 2011 at the same time. So we really galvanised our efforts at trying to work out what was going on.
And you're under control now?
The cases have dropped back. We've had a good wet season. The latency between the acquisition of the bacteria and the manifestation of the ulcer, we think, is around 6 to 7 months. So we're just getting into the period where we might start to see more cases.
But in a sense, you're out of control of it. You've just got to pick them up until you find out what the environmental
control is. The treatment is relatively straightforward. If you catch the ulcers when they're small, you can cut them out. Or if they're a little bit bigger, there's a combination of antibiotics, a fairly complex regimen of antibiotics you can use, which is now very successful. But I suppose our research question is, how are people catching it? And it's probably got something to do with mosquitoes and small mammals. So we've been trapping mosquitoes, we've been trapping
Scott
small
Ritchie
mammals.
Scott Ritchie to the rescue, clearly, with his Scott's, back here.
Scott's helping us out
and
with the
Scott's
mosquitoes.
Scott's still in the studio, sitting in the background, pulling the strings. Look, thank you very much to you all, but particularly thanks to John McBride, Professor of Medicine at James Cook University. This has been the Health Report. See you next time.